is Christopher Long, and you're listening to The Digital Dialogue, a podcast dedicated to cultivating the excellences of dialogue in a digital age. This is episode 15, and today I'm joined by Holly Moore, who defended her dissertation entitled Plato's Analogical Thought at DePaul University last week on October 12th, 2009. So congratulations, Dr. Moore.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Yeah. Holly is a graduate of Penn State's undergraduate program in philosophy. In fact, she did her honors thesis with Professor Mark Munn, who joined me for episode 12 of The Digital Dialogue, in which we discussed his project on the relationship between Eros and democracy. So I invite listeners to go and listen to that as well. Holly is currently a visiting professor at Colby College. Is that correct, a visiting professor?
That's right. I'm a faculty fellow.
Excellent. And Holly's dissertation, which is why she's here to talk to us a little bit about her dissertation, argues for the intimate connection between Plato's use of images and his ultimate philosophical teaching. More specifically, she insists that the images Plato articulates and the story his philosophy has to tell about images are inextricably connected. For Holly, Plato is an analogical thinker because the self-reflection and relational structure of analogies express something decisive about Platonic thinking. So it's a great pleasure to welcome Dr. Holly Moore to The Digital Dialogue.
Thank you very much, Chris. I really appreciate this opportunity. I've been following your Digital Dialogue myself, and I think it's a fantastic project, so I'm glad to be part of it.
Well, thank you, and I'm glad to have you on, especially particularly not only as a longtime colleague of mine in the Ancient Philosophy Society, but also as a very successful graduate of the Penn State undergraduate program.
Yes, and I owe quite a lot to it, I think. I learned how to read Plato there, so a lot of what I've become has its roots in Penn State's philosophy program.
Excellent. Well, I would like it if you could talk a little bit about your dissertation and what led you to the topic that you focused on, and maybe a little bit about the structure of the dissertation itself. And I think that'll lead us into some interesting discussions about the relationship between mythos and logos and the place of poetry and Plato's philosophy and a number of the other themes that we've been talking about in the Digital Dialogue in episodes past.
Yes, I think it will. It's one of the reasons I've been interested in the threads that you've been following, is because it's very compatible with the work that I've been doing. So I began the work that sort of started the dissertation was an interest I had in the Timaeus in particular, and in the sort of central portion of what's termed the chorology, which is this really difficult passage that many thinkers have sort of labored over. And the thing that struck me about it is that there is a series of sort of failed attempts at accounting for this third kind, this sort of unfathomable space for the intersection of being and becoming.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's imaged in a number of different ways. It's imaged as gold, as a perfume base, as a mother, as a nurse, and then finally this term chora becomes sort of the moniker for what we're talking about. But it appears that it's never really an accomplished goal. The figuring of that idea is never really complete.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really just had a question over why it is that these images are failing. What it is about the thing that he's trying to think there. The images can't do the work for him, but it appears neither can any other form of expression accomplish the job either.
So just to be clear, the impetus behind the project really comes out of an engagement with Plato's Timaeus, in which this idea of the chora is introduced. And the question becomes, what kind of an image is this image of that which can't be imaged?
That's right. So it really sort of began there. And, in my work on Cora and sort of what's happening there, what I came to believe is that Cora is really an image for the possibility of imaging.
Mm-hmm.
Because what it's supposed to be is sort of this, breeding ground for becoming, right? The introduction of the forms into appearance.
Mm-hmm.
And so it does sort of stand as the possibility of this mimetic metaphysics that sort of dominates Plato's thought. Mm-hmm. And I started there sort of wondering if it was sort of the use of all of these images prior to Cora that made Cora look like that in the first place. Huh. It made it look like an image of imaging.
I see.
And so from there, though, I decided that really the problem seemed to be embedded in the metaphysics itself. Mm-hmm. Because of the fact that the way that Plato understands the forms is on a model of imaging.
I see.
So this is why I went on to do more work specifically in the Republic and in the Phaedo, trying to sort of locate the basis of this problem.
Mm-hmm.
And in my analysis in the Republic, I focused on book six and the development of the Son and the Good analogy.
Right.
Because obviously I wanted to look at sort of the work of analogy and well, there's sort of the greatest one. And what I noticed was that the Son is posited as the image of the good first.
Right.
Then after the image has been explained, he says, so the Son is to the visible what the good is to the intelligible. And this is the sort of explicit expression of the analogy itself.
Mm-hmm.
So at that point, I got interested in how it is that images and analogy in particular are in relation, because it seems like analogies are just another kind of image, right?
Uh-huh.
They're just one among many. We can talk about, you know, metaphor, we can talk about simile, we can talk about analogy, they're all images, right?
Right.
But it became more clear to me that there's something peculiar about analogy and about the structure that analogy has, sort of formally,
mm-hmm.
That allows it to provide a sort of reference within imaging to imaging.
I see.
And this is because analogy has a four-term structure.
Right.
So instead of the sort of two-term structure of an image, right, one thing is like another thing.
Right.
An analogy allows you to reflect upon relationships. So one set of relationships over here, namely between the Son and visible things,
right,
is similar to the relationships that hold between the good and the intelligible things. So what you're able to achieve with an analogy is a relationship of similarity that maintains a reference to difference.
I see.
Whereas if you were to relate two things just as similar, you have to, in a sense, bury the difference between them.
Mm-hmm.
But in an analogy, you actually expose both the similarity and the difference at the same time. And so what I'm really claiming is that analogy becomes a really important philosophical concept,
right?
Not just a rhetorical mode, but a philosophical concept that allows Plato to figure the thinking he's trying to do. He's trying to accomplish a thinking of similarity and difference.
Right. Well, I wonder in that context that sort of what happened. I mean, there's something that is implicit here, I think, and I'm wondering if you draw this out in mm-hmm. a substantive way in the dissertation, that it's not only the positing of the analogy that's critical, but also the capacity to take the analogy up in words,
mm-hmm.
In such a way that the differences that make a difference are articulated, and the similarities that are relevant and important are also affirmed. So there's a way in which part of what it seems that, from my perspective, that Socrates is doing when he introduces these analogies,
mm-hmm.
Although I understand it's not always Socrates, so I appreciate the fact that
yeah.
you're really associating this with Plato, so you talk about in the Timaeus, and even
sure.
in the Statesman, I know, is another dialogue
yes.
you focus
yes.
on where it's really yeah. not Socrates who's introducing the analogies. But when these analogies are introduced, they're not just abstractly introduced. They are introduced as things to be discussed and worked through.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, they're not, I'm glad you referenced the statesman work that I've done too. They're not accidental. And I think this is the thing that we often pose, or I should say oppose, mm-hmm. These sort of, these lapses, as it were, or these didactic, pedagogical attempts to, you know, engage the common understanding of the person, whoever we're speaking with. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that that's actually the function of imaging at all. And I also don't think that it's just an accident. You don't just pick something at random. You pick something that's suited to your task. So in The Statesman, the example that he uses in sort of the final analysis of The Statesman to sort of compare their own definition of the statesman too is the weaver.
Right.
And it becomes a really elaborate metaphor in the end that in a sense he could have never said the things he wants to say about the statesman in the first place if he didn't have the weaving metaphor to go from.
Right.
So the sort of the weaving of souls and there's sort of weaving is operating at a number of levels for the statesman.
So maybe we could look at that a little bit as an example of because I'd like to hear a little bit more about the relationship between analogy and imaging. So mm-hmm. so you if I understood you correctly from what you just said and from what you sent me to read in terms of your summary of your dissertation,
mm-hmm.
That you recognize that an analogy is one sort of way of imaging, but you want to argue that it has a kind of privileged position.
It does. In terms of, it has a privileged position for philosophy in particular, because if philosophy needs to account for the image, and I make a longer argument about how philosophy is really beholden to that argument. I don't think it's a mistake that Plato sort of took up imaging as one of his major problems.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's really a problem for philosophy. But if you're going to give an account of imaging, then you are, in a sense, reflecting on imaging.
Mm-hmm.
You're reflecting on a reflection, which is this sort of strange, you know, sounds like a play on words, really. But
right.
What I was saying before about how analogy allows us to relate relations, right? To put into relationship things that are already in relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So analogy ends up being able to provide us a sort of framework of how to abstract from imaging while remaining in it.
Uh-huh. In what sense is it abstracting?
It's abstracting in the sense that there's an additional layer of mediation. Okay. So instead of merely saying, one-to-one correspondence or one-to-two correspondence, right, if you even think in terms of ratios,
mm-hmm.
right, an analogy puts two ratios into relationship with each other.
I see.
So instead of sort of providing a reflection in one direction,
mm-hmm.
you can reflect on the reflecting itself. I know that's a little complicated.
No, I
put it
but
in that
I mean,
way.
Is there is your so your suggestion is that there's something fundamental about an analogy that forces us into, or at least invites us to reflect on what exactly is being articulated or expressed by this complex kind of set of relationships that the analogy is establishing.
That's right. I mean, I think one of the sort of key points of my argument is to say that in order to understand an image,
mm-hmm.
one is already thinking the analogy that holds between the two things. If let's say we take a metaphor, Richard is a lion. Unless I'm going to make the mistake of thinking that's literal,
right.
I have to, in order to understand the metaphor, actually engage a whole set of relationships about what it is to be a lion.
Mm-hmm.
And then transfer that set of relationships over to who Richard is, right? That
right.
he's a a king among, you know, a king among kings, and sort of rules with an authority that can't be questioned.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm saying is, in a sense, we are already, when we're trying to understand images, operating at the level of analogies.
Okay, but I guess I'm a little bit confused about the what is it that an analogy as such is giving you that, let's say, as your example already had, of a metaphor, doesn't. So it seemed like on your own example that the metaphor was giving you this self-reflective capacity.
Mm. Well, I think actually the point is not whether or not any particular expression is itself an analogy.
Mm-hmm.
Because in fact, a lot of my analysis is upon things that are not expressed as analogies, but are images. And then, you know, in order to explain them, in order to understand them, we have to sort of go through a process of analysis that reveals the analogy that underlies it.
Mm-hmm. But I thought part of your point was that the analogy, because it doesn't because it articulates something more complex than this one-to-one relationship,
mm-hmm.
there's something in the very relationality expressed in an analogy.
Yes.
That Plato wants to highlight, and you argue is critical to philosophical reflection and philosophical engagement with the world.
Yeah, that's right. So maybe I could give an example of how I sort of produce that effect, because it is really hard, because what I'm trying to move from is away from sort of identifying particular things as analogical, particular instances of rhetorical forms that could be called analogies, and more trying to show the way that the thinking moves is itself producing a sort of analogical framework.
Okay.
So again, back to the Republic. So in analyzing the relationship between the sun and the good analogy, it's expressed within the text itself that the divided line is supposed to be an explanation of this relationship, because it's not entirely clear to Glaucon at the time
what
precisely he's talking about here. And he says, so let's do this other thing. He says, Glaucon, take this line and divide it unevenly.
Right.
And then divide each side of that divided line in the same ratio. He says, anatanata logon. He says the sort of formulation that points to analogy. And this sort of, if you just take a look at the line itself, the line acts as a sort of image of the way analogy works, in the sense that there are two things put into a relation on one side,
right?
That have a proportional relationship to each other as the other two on the other side do to each other.
Uh-huh.
And in a sense, what I'm saying is that the reason why the line gets drawn in that way is because it's already sort of beneath the surface of the analogy in the first place, the sun and the good analogy that sort of started the whole thing off.
I see.
So, in a sense, right? It's the divided line is not precisely an analogy. I guess most precisely, it's an image. I think, sort of a constructed image.
Mm-hmm.
But its character, you know, sort of what it looks like, just in the sense of its structure, is analogical.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's because it's a reflection upon this prior relationship.
Well, I mean, do you play this out in any sense in the dissertation in terms of a certain kind of finitude? And by that I mean that, so one of the things that always strikes me about any analogy is that it always works and yet it doesn't work. That there are always limits to how the analogy is really effective and how these things can be compared. And then at a certain point in every conversation I've ever had with students, we, in thinking through these things, we sort of say, yeah, but then it's different because of this. And this may go back to your point about similarity and difference and a way of articulating the two together. But do you cash that out in terms of finitude, or do you, sort of focus on the issue of similarity and difference?
I think that's a really that's a really good point about the problem that, that this points to in the first place. And I do in the sense that I do point to finitude in the sense that I, the way I sort of figure this at is that we are drawn, as philosophers, we are drawn to, when we reflect on images, think analogically, because of the limits of thinking in reflecting upon itself. So in a sense, analogy is actually as adequate as it gets. And in a sense, it's far more adequate than imaging in its own right, because it at least allows reflection upon that, upon the distance between the reflection and what we're reflecting on.
Well, I mean, and of course, the appeal to analogies in the terms of the history of philosophy has often been used to reference sort of that with respect to which humans don't have access. So in the Middle Ages, for example, you know, analogies used all the time to try and get at something of the nature of the divine, even if we can't access it directly.
And in fact, you've hit on one of the main intuitions of this project, is to sort of provide a philosophical history of the concept of analogy and how it comes to be effective philosophically. And I think it's precisely in that moment where you can see that lineage that, in a sense, it's built for that problem. And I want to say that it really is constructed. It's a concept that comes to be in response to this problem. And while Plato doesn't theorize analogy as a method, he's using it. And in a sense, he's theorizing things that end up being analogical as well. So we're almost there. I think Aristotle is where it really starts to, take hold.
Well, I would like to talk a little bit more about the whole issue of methodology and how you're conceiving that with respect to analogy. But I wanted to go back for a second to the issue of the reflective activity that analogies encourage us to undertake. And specifically, I'm interested in the issue of somehow you link this, and I think rightly, but I'd like to hear more about it. Somehow you link this to the injunction to know thyself, and so this this whole sort of Socratic and ultimately Delphic injunction to know thyself. Now, this may be just another way of me asking about the finitude question, but still.
No, that's fine.
I'd like to hear a little bit more about how you see these appeals to analogies as bound up with the question of knowing oneself and the kind of reflection on who and what one is and the context in which one lives.
I'm really interested in that being a result of my work. So I'm really glad that you brought that up. One of the pieces that I found that just kind of, sparked my interest, and I decided to write on it a bit out of Plato's work, was it goes directly to the point of this Delphic inscription, is the Alcibiades I passage, where Socrates is talking to Alcibiades and trying to convince him to pursue the philosophic life and, not to engage in this ambitious attempt to, magnify himself. And he says that what Alcibiades really needs and is lacking is a knowledge of himself, mm-hmm. that he doesn't know his own limits.
Right.
And he sort of projects himself as much greater than he actually is. And Socrates says, and I can't give you that. Like I can't make you know yourself.
Mm-hmm.
He says, what we need is something like, and he says, it's as if the Delphic Oracle were to say to the eye, see thyself.
Mm.
And then the question is, how does an eye see itself? Mm-hmm. How can an eye see itself? And Alcibiades, the clever student that he is, says, well, it could be reflected in something else. It could be reflected to itself.
Mm-hmm.
And Socrates turns him away from the idea of using a mirror, actually,
uh-huh.
toward the idea of seeing himself in another eye, which he says is much more appropriate, because a mirror is not like the eye. It's just an image of it.
Right.
Whereas if the eye is to look at itself in another eye, that's far more appropriate in terms of being reflective,
mm-hmm.
Which I find really fascinating. It's a really great and interesting idea.
So you're not arguing that really what analogy does, if, for example, is just provide a more originary ground for mm-hmm. the entire patriarchal understanding, let's say, of logos, but rather that it in fact it does provide a certain kind of ground, but the ground
yes.
is problematic.
Absolutely, it's a grounding that's necessary in a sense, but at the same time sort of compromises itself.
Uh-huh.
In being the ground of what it's the ground for. So, it's not as though Cora is the aim of the cosmology,
right.
the cosmogony of the Timaeus.
Mm-hmm.
The aim is really to articulate the role of the forms in their sort of insinuation into appearance.
Mm.
But the only way to do that is by reference to this, this bastard logos.
Right. Right. And then, I mean, that formulation itself, right, the bastard logos, is part of what Platonic thinking gives voice to.
Yes. Yes. And I think that's a nice way of putting it. That in a certain sense, there's a place for it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's given a very particular place. But I think that it's not acknowledged
mm-hmm.
as essential
mm-hmm.
as I think it really is.
Right.
I think it's actually required. It's not just a choice. And I think this is, part of the tradition of reading Plato is to see that these images and things like that are entirely separable.
Right.
From the thinking.
But you're not arguing that there's a place for it. You're arguing that it in fact is a critical and fundamental part
yeah.
of doing philosophy, or even as in a certain sense maybe the condition for the possibility of doing philosophy. I don't
yes.
know if you'd embrace that language, but
yeah, I try not to be too transcendental about it, but but I do think in the end actually you're reading, I think, the intent,
mm-hmm.
and what I think is, I need to be very honest about it. A very modern reappropriation.
Right.
I don't take myself to be providing a reading that is Plato, or that is Platonist.
Uh-huh.
I think it's a reading of both the sort of inheritance of this tradition.
Mm-hmm.
As well as the resources that it allows for us today.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah.
But, I mean, I don't know that you need to give up on the reading. I think you're right to say it's not Platonist, because
mm-hmm.
it's certainly not rooted in the sort of tradition of Platonism as opposed
yeah.
to the wet manner in which Plato articulated his thinking. But
uh-huh.
It certainly is a reading of the Platonic text that
yes.
it responds to what is found there. So
it's, absolutely. No, I don't mean to give that up. That's right. Precisely what I see myself as, is a reader of Plato's texts. But in a sense, I think it, in concert with a sort of, skepticism about the tradition,
right,
that it comes, that it comes to sort of, that comes to take it up.
Well, this has been great. I mean, we've now ended probably at exactly the right point, where we are in a mode of self-reflection and come to the limits, perhaps, of our own ability to articulate maybe what Plato was in fact.
Yeah, all we need now is an image, right?
Exactly. Right. So, Holly, really, thank you for coming on the Digital Dialogue, and I look forward to more conversations in the future.
Me too. Thank you so much, Chris. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Digital Dialogue is produced under a Creative Commons non-commercial share alike license. To download or subscribe to the Digital Dialogue, visit iTunes U on the Apple iTunes Store and search on Digital Dialogue. You will find it under the Pennsylvania State University area of the iTunes Store. You may also visit my website, The Long Road, at www.personal.psu.edu/cpl2. This has been the Digital Dialogue.